Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
It's another Friday afternoon, and it's always Friday, isn't it? It is indeed. Anyhow, where am I going to? I'm after losing my train of thought, but you are tuned to another episode of The Sideshow, and I've been asked to note at the start of The Sideshow that I am your host, Peter Donegan. I think this is my first time to ever say that in 300 and something episodes of the show on the go since 2011. Wow, don't I feel a little bit old? Let's get past me. If you want to get in touch, it's at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow and Sideshow.com. And if you're listening to this in iTunes, feel free to press that middle button right now. Go there, leave a rate and review. Apparently it does something to make me feel a little bit, I won't say better looking, but more popular. It'll boost my ego. It'll make you feel good. I'm unsure how, but it'll make you feel good anyway. Let's get to today's guest. She is Stephanie Mahon. She is a fellow member of the Garden Media Guild. And from there, should you not be aware of Stephanie, it says, and I quote, presently the editor of the Garden Design Journal, previously of the English Garden. She writes for newspapers and magazines, including The Telegraph, The Guardian, The Sunday Times, Home and Gardens, Country Living, and the list goes on. It gets to the good bit where she was the winner of the Garden Media Guild New Talent Award in 2009 and Journalist of the Year 2012. Stephanie Mahon, you're very welcome to the Sideshow.
Thank you very much. Long time fan. Delighted to be on the show.
You're the first person I've had on the Sideshow that has ever told me that they're a long time fan.
Really?
Yeah, that's the equivalent of being in the Galtymore Dance Hall in Cricklewood when I used to go there to try and woo a lady from afar, and you saying to me, I've been watching you dance for the last 6 years. I was a terrible dancer, so that would never happen. Stephanie, let's get past me getting slightly big-headed. I know I've read your bio of sorts, if you want to call it that, but what do you do for a living?
I suppose it sounds great when you read it out like that, but I suppose it's really when you're freelance, as I am, you do everything you can, really, to make a living. So, yeah, I do edit the Garden Design Journal, which is the magazine of the Society of Garden Designers, but that's part-time. And then I desperately pitch every other editor out there to get articles into magazines and newspapers. And this year, for the first time, I've started sort of giving talks. So I chaired a conference and I just gave a talk at the Landscape Show. So that was quite scary. And I hope nobody who was there knew that those were my first proper speaking engagements. I hope I didn't betray myself too much. But I decided this year I was going to say yes to every opportunity, which has taken me to Sicily and Berlin and Spain and all sorts of places. And it's been fantastic, if exhausting. So I suppose the answer is I do anything and everything. I'll give interviews on the radio. This is my first ever interview, would you believe, where somebody has been interviewing me. I'll do whatever, really. I'm open to any opportunity to talk about gardening and to write or to speak or anything like that.
Well, let's get into this one, because I went through some of the things that you have written for. So again, for those of you who may not be aware, and whilst I do stumble across stuff you've written and you've been on my radar for some time, and by the way, I should note, we've been trying to get this interview to happen since before Chelsea 2017, where for the first time ever made a list of people I should interview and got to absolutely none of them. So I'm going to revert to what I did at Tatton 2017, make no plans at all, and continue in that format, and it works out a heck of a lot better. But you have written for The Guardian, House to Home, The Garden Design Journal, logically, Country Living, The English Garden Magazine, The Sunday Times, The Garden Design Journal, The Irish Times, The Telegraph. I mean, the list literally goes on. And the last one that I actually read before I went to Chelsea 2017, you wrote the preview for The Telegraph.
I know. I'm very lucky. I mean, if I go back in time a bit, I suppose I decided when I was about 14 that I wanted to be a writer. And you, I don't know if your listeners would know, but you might know the Irish writer Joseph O'Connor.
Yep.
Yeah, so I read a book of his called The Secret Life of the Irish Male, and I just thought it was fantastic. I'd never read anything like it before. I read it again recently, and it's a little bit dated now, but I really enjoyed it when I was that age. And I decided right there and then I was going to be a writer, to which my parents, they weren't so keen on the idea. They didn't really see it as a career as such. And they sort of said to me, well, if you can prove that you can make a living doing this, then fine. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have to take over your mother's orthodontic practice. So that was the option in front of me. And so I was that really annoying kid in school who started the school newspaper, which we'd never had one before. And that makes it sound very interesting and like, oh, my God, a school newspaper. It was two pieces of A4 stapled together, you know, where we slagged off the teachers and said, you know, so-and-so fancied so-and-so. It really wasn't that exciting. But it was a good start. And it meant that I actually wrote to Joseph O'Connor and I said, I want to be a writer and I really like your work. And could I come and interview you for my school newspaper? And he was so amazing. He said, yes. And so I went up to Bewley's in Dublin and met him for a coffee. And he I interviewed him and he was just so wonderful, really supportive, really nice. And gave me lots of encouragement and advice. And yeah, so that was sort of where it all started. And he told me, just write to people, just, you know, write to everybody, start writing things and start sending them in. And I think it's really good advice for anyone who wants to be a journalist or a writer, no matter what age they are. Just, you know, nobody's going to discover you or come knocking on your door. You have to go out and make yourself available to people. So I did. So when I was the summer that I was leaving school, just after my leaving cert, which I don't know, I guess it's a bit like A-levels maybe in Britain, I'm not sure. The year that you leave school, the big exams that you do. I wrote a piece and I sent it into the Irish Times, which is the paper of record in Ireland. Basically, the article was just complaining about the fact, it was a big moan. It was basically saying that this was supposed to be the best summer of my life after the exams were finished. And actually, it turned out to be incredibly boring. And I was very lucky because the features editor at the time was just about to start looking for someone to write about exam results and university and different things. And I just happened to send this piece in at the right time. And she called me up and asked me if I would write a few things for her. And I just couldn't believe this was happening to me. Like the Irish Times, wow, score on your first time out. It was just incredible. But I do realize I was just really lucky that I was in the right place at the right time. And that I'd sent something in that she was interested in. So that was also a really good lesson in terms of when you're pitching someone, again, advice for anyone who would like to write or be a journalist, is to think about what the editor that you're writing to is looking for. This is what I was talking about at my landscape show talk a few weeks ago, which was just for people who in the industry want to know how to get their work in magazines or how to write for newspapers or magazines, is just general advice, like common sense. Is to look at the products that you're writing, you want to write for, and to see the kinds of things that they publish, and then to try and match those closely as you can. So I was very, very lucky to have that early experience with the Irish Times. And that set me up because obviously that sounds incredibly impressive, but really it was, you know, it was a few articles that I wrote while I was in university. And I think that's one of the reasons then that I managed to get into the master's program in journalism when I was still quite young. And but when I came out of university, I was unemployed for a year, like an awful lot of people in Ireland at that stage. You know, there weren't that many media jobs around or creative jobs. It wasn't quite the same as it is now. So I worked as an assistant for somebody, personal assistant, played a lot of solitaire on their computer. And I also worked as an elf in a Santa theme park. I don't know if you remember Santa's Kingdom in Goth, which was a bit of a disaster. I think it didn't, it was a little bit, yes, there was a lot of staff, there was a lot of things going on constantly. So I worked there for a while. I had to wear a jumper that said, "Have you been good?" And a lot of very interesting Santa and elf related things happened there. So that was how I managed to get through that year of being unemployed. I made a bit of money and went to Australia, like a lot of Irish people did at that stage as well. And when I came back, I was lucky enough to land my first proper job, which was for a trade magazine, the Irish Marketing and Advertising Journal. So I got a lot of experience there in terms of how magazines are put together and long hours and deadlines, that kind of thing.
A lot of writers I know, Stephanie, I guess baffles me slightly of how somebody who studied journalism, you might assume that they would write a novel or a book, so to speak, along those lines. Or, I don't know, something that would make me sit by the window and ponder looking over a bay somewhere whilst drinking Darjeeling tea. Or at least that's the picture I have in my head. But to end up writing about gardens, how did that bit click in for you?
Well, after I'd been a journalist in Ireland for a good few years, all my friends were sort of getting mortgages and babies and things, and I wasn't really ready for that at that stage. And so I decided to, I guess you'd call it take a sabbatical, but really it was just running away. I decided to go and help a friend of mine, a crazy American guy called Clark. He was living in Italy, and he was in... He'd rented part of this old rundown medieval castle in the countryside near Bologna, and he wanted some help getting it off the ground. It was called Reading Retreats in Rural Italy, and it was a place where people could go to, I suppose it was a B&B for bibliophiles. It was, you know, if you liked to read and you liked to hang out with other people, then you could go there, and you didn't have to read a thing, you could just hang out all day. And so he was needing a bit of help having moved to this place. And I said I'd go and help him for a little while. But I was there for 3 years. And I had no interest in gardening at all when I arrived. But he was crazy about, he didn't know anything, but he wanted to make a garden. And over those 3 years, he sort of infected me with his enthusiasm. And I slowly started to get into making the garden too, and got my hands dirty and planted a lot. And we would, you know, create different areas like a kitchen garden and a sort of a big English planted courtyard. And so when I moved to the UK, after that experience, the day I landed off the plane, there was a job ad for a sub-editor writer in the English Garden magazine. I just thought, well, that's perfect. That's matching my new passion for gardening with my skills. And so I went for the job and I was lucky enough to get it. And then over the next few years, I sort of moved up through the ranks from sub-editor all the way up to editor until I was running the magazine. So, and that was a really wonderful experience. And I trained in horticulture at night time while I was doing that too, because I wanted to have the qualification. I needed to fill in the gaps in my knowledge. So it was just, I guess it was pure chance that, you know, my friend just happened to be interested in gardening and then managed to persuade me to be interested in it too, until it became an all-consuming passion. And I was, again, right place, right time. Just there happened to be that job available at the time, and it was exactly what I would have wanted.
Do you remember the first article that you wrote, Stephanie?
I think it was for Wychford Pottery. Jim has his own garden just outside the pottery, their private garden, not the one that people usually see. And I think my first assignment was to go and to meet him, and he's great crack, and to have a look around his private garden with Harriet, who was the gardener then as well. And I remember that really fondly, actually. I remember my first few articles because I had so much to learn. And so I'd sort of start out quite intimidated and then realize, oh, I do know the plants that they're talking about. I don't need to feel quite so worried about that. I knew more than I thought I did.
Do you look back on those articles, Stephanie, and a bit like when they play footage of Boyzone? Okay, bear with me, folks, for those of you listening at home. But there is a video clip of Boyzone on
The Late Late Show.
On The Late Late Show, indeed. It's the equivalent of, for those of you not aware, of let's say, Terry Wogan hosting a Friday night chat show. And I mean, it is absolute cringeworthy, even the Westlife, whoever boy band or girl band. Do you look back and go, oh, Jesus, what did I do?
It was pretty tragic, yeah. Gosh, I haven't looked at those articles in quite a long time, actually, those first ones. No, I mean, I guess I think I put so much work into them. I had a bit of the liberty of a bit of time, and I probably worked at night on them and stuff too. I probably would have put so much of myself into making sure that they were exactly what I wanted them to be. You know, I was paranoid possibly about, you know, not doing a good job and wanting them to be as fantastic as possible. So I have a look back. I must actually go back and read them. I read some of the stuff from when I was a lot younger, like the stuff I wrote for the Irish Times at 17. And yeah, I cringe a bit at that. I just think, oh, I cringe a bit at that. I think, oh, the attitude, the tone was, you know, I was emulating people like Joseph O'Connor and Zoe Heller, people who were writing in the Sunday supplements and being very confessional and personal. And I would never write like that now. So I find that slightly cringy. Yeah.
Have you written, do I ask, what would have been the most, I say controversial, and to clarify that for those of you listening, I think there are gardens that I've done that people would have considered, inverted commas, controversial. And I always say in horticulture, it's never really that controversial. Mm. But have you ever written an article where you've got a bit of stick back on it?
I've just written an article like that, which will be in the Telegraph in the next few weeks. And it's probably the first article that I actually have a bit of a worry about whether it'll be controversial or not. I'm constantly surprised at how people react to things, actually. Something that you think is quite innocuous can often end up setting people off. And other times you think, oh, maybe this is going to be a bit dramatic and people will react to it. And everyone's just sort of like, yeah, it's all okay. So I'm not actually sure if this piece I've written, which is about designer tastes in gardening, as opposed to a normal home gardener. So something like the Chelsea Flower Show is a good example of, you know, a show garden versus what somebody would have in their own garden. And the difference in, you know, the finances, so how expensive a designer-looking garden can be and the kinds of things that are in it. And so in this article, I'm kind of investigating what's behind that and why that's the case. And so, yes, I'll be very interested to see what the reaction to that article is when it comes out in a few weeks' time in the Telegraph. So everyone can look out for that and let me know what they think.
Well, talk to me a little bit then about the Garden Design Journal. It's a magazine that I have to admit that I'm not as familiar with, to be quite fair. So you'll need to, I guess, educate me a little bit on that one, Stephanie.
Well, it is the Society of Garden Designers, which is the trade body for garden designers in the UK. And so they have this magazine, monthly magazine called the Garden Design Journal, which is for their members, but it's also available on subscription, so anybody can have it. And we do find that there's an awful lot of people in the industry internationally and in the UK subscribe to the magazine as well. And it's, you know, we try our best to make it look as good as possible, so it can kind of sort of try to compete on the same level as some of the bigger consumer gardening magazines that you find on the newsstand. But at heart, it is definitely 100% aimed at garden designers, and it's all about their concerns and their work. So, you know, if we do a planting feature, it's very much from the point of view of designers, the kind of things that they would be interested in. So it's a little bit more, I wouldn't say technical, but definitely more focused in places and a little bit more technical in others. So if we do a garden feature, we're very interested in the construction element of it and the design behind it and all of the thinking behind it. Rather than, let's say, interviewing the owner about how much they enjoy being in their garden, it's definitely more from the point of view of the designer and exactly how they came up with the idea and the concept and how it was created. So, but it still probably looks a lot more like a normal gardening magazine than other trade magazines, because we do try very hard to make sure the photography is beautiful and that it's as attractive as it can be to as many people as possible. But I've been editing it now for 2 years, I just realised. I started it in October 2015, and I really enjoy it. It's fantastic. I got to meet a whole new side of the industry. I knew some designers before I started on this magazine, and I thought I understood the way they think about the industry and their business, but I realised afterwards that I thought I knew about it, but I didn't know enough. And so it's been really eye-opening, and I've really enjoyed it. I found the members of the society when I meet them at events and at conferences and things. They're just really interested, really creative, and really friendly, you know, been really welcoming and helpful for me for taking on this role, coming in from the outside and maybe not knowing as much as I need to. So it's been really good.
Do you find that a little bit of a two-way street, Stephanie? On the one hand, how do I say this? Without, so the Sideshow doesn't do or tries to avoid, Peter Donegan tries to avoid controversy as best as possible, but I still have four sisters and somehow or another I still end up in trouble, et cetera, the list goes on. On the one hand, you have written for the Telegraph, the Guardian et al. About gardens, and therefore there logically has to be or is a certain element of, shall I call it, criticism, maybe, of either A gardens or B garden shows. And now you're working and writing with Society of Garden Designers. Do you get designers who come up to you and say, Stephanie, come on, that piece you wrote 14, 12, 2.5 years ago about me, and now I'm your best mate? Does that sit with you? Do you get what I'm saying there?
I haven't actually experienced that, I'll be honest. I think, how would I say this? I think the magazines that I've written for before, you know, I think they're what people would term, you know, nice or lovely garden magazines. So you just don't, I mean, the way that I used to always work it on the English Garden was there's no point in covering something that isn't good enough to feature, you know. So you wouldn't ever be negative because you wouldn't be publishing things that you would be negative about, if that makes sense. It's a bit like a book review. I don't agree with doing a horrible book review. I think if the book isn't good enough, don't review it in the first place. So that was how we always operated before. And with the Garden Design Journal, it would be the same. As if something wasn't good enough, it wouldn't appear in the pages in the first place. I've never experienced that. But I think when you're an editor, and especially when you're an editor of a consumer magazine that people buy on the newsstand, people have made a choice to buy your magazine. So they will see it, they will decide that it's for them, that they like what's in it, and then they'll purchase it and bring it home. Whereas I think the difference with a trade magazine that people, or a subscription magazine that people get through their letterbox, sometimes as part of a membership deal, is that they look at it differently. They just happen to receive this product. And so, and also, you know, designers are very straight. They will tell you if they don't like something you're doing. So that's been a bit of a learning curve in that, completely fairly, an awful lot of the readers want the magazine to be a certain thing. They want to feature this, that, and the other. And so as an editor, as part of your job, you have to, I wouldn't even call it criticism, but you have to be open to people's views and opinions and take them in. And some people are very good at letting you know what they think without, you know, without it causing a problem. And other people have, they want to let you know what they think, but it can be difficult to take because you can start taking things quite personally. So what you have to do is just understand that, you know, people's views and opinions, you have to take them into account, and you're trying to deliver something that they want. You have to make sure that you've covered all the bases. And if you are ignoring a section of people who want something to go in the magazine, well, that's a problem. You should be making sure that they're happy because it is for them. So it's really part of the job, and you just have to separate it out from your personal self and decide, you know, as an editor, it's always going to be this way. People are always going to tell you that you're not doing this right or that right or the other. It just comes with the territory, I think. You have to have a thicker skin, I think, than in some other jobs, because people have no problem telling you what they think.
Well, have you ever got criticism? And this is, I'm not, don't get me wrong, these are just general questions that have, as always, you say in brackets, that pop into Peter's head. They can sometimes be way away with the fairies, and sometimes they're just generally inquisitive things. And I'll back this up by saying, I remember reading an article, I think it was Chelsea 2016, and in it, it described Paul Martin, who was on Main Avenue that year. And I think it was just one line that they had given him, a bit of a dark horse, I believe it was, and a relative unknown. And it was nothing else really afterwards. But have you ever got criticism for something, even a one-liner, a throwaway comment that you again thought was relatively innocuous, but you didn't mean it in a bad way, and you get that?
I can't think of that situation. I mean, maybe you know more than I do. maybe nobody has said it to my face and has been angry about something I've written. But certainly I've never had anyone contact me with an issue about something I've written. I don't know if that's because, like I say, maybe they just haven't said it to me personally, or if it's a case of I make sure that, you know, when I quote someone, I quote them properly. I try to make sure that I'm being as straight and as clear as possible. I'm not trying to cause controversy, so I try and make sure that I show all sides of the argument. I quote people correctly, so that they can't say, oh, I didn't say that. Yeah, I mean, like you say, in gardening, it's one of those things where it's sort of hard to believe that there could ever be controversy about anything. And I think when there is, it often comes down to, I suppose, something a bit like a book review or something when somebody, or a film review, when somebody decides as a critic that they're going to put themselves first and they're going to glorify themselves a little bit in the way that they're writing negatively about someone. And I've never done that. And I try to do my research. I try to make sure that when I'm writing about someone, I know about their past, and I definitely wouldn't consider Paul Martin a dark horse or have come out of nowhere. So I find that very interesting. I think sometimes it's because if the newspapers are writing about things, that they might have a staff journalist who isn't maybe a specialist in gardens and maybe wouldn't know the industry so well. But I don't know any other reason for why they would say that about Paul Martin. That's really interesting.
Well, if we take, for example, the M&G Garden by James Basson, James and Helen, I should say. Personally, I thought it was a piece of absolute genius. And that's what I said at the time. That's what I stood by. And I still stand by that. How did you sit on what we shall now call not controversy of Chelsea 2017, Stephanie?
Well, it was so interesting because this is why I wrote this article in The Telegraph that's coming out soon. And that's actually the starting point for it, was the two things that happened this year. So there was the reaction to James and Helen Basson's garden, the Quarry Garden, and then, you know, completely separately, but got pulled into the same sort of orbit, was the fact that Chris Beardshaw's garden didn't get a gold medal. And so it was sort of like Twitter especially just completely blew up about these two things because they all happened in the same year, whereby an awful lot of people didn't like what James and Helen did on their garden. Get it, or they got it but they didn't like it, and then with Chris's, you know, it was an arts and crafts garden. It was, you know, full of colourful flowers, it harked back to that sort of feeling of you know, English planting style, and people really, really liked it, but it didn't achieve the top medal, and there was a lot of questions about why that was. And James Alexander Sinclair, who heads the judging panel, he, you know, came on television and walked through a garden and explained how they judged the gardens. And that was really interesting because I think it was the first time that the RHS felt that they should do that, that they had to explain the judging. So I've been talking about this and talking to people about this exact thing that happened at Chelsea this year for, you know, for the month since. And that was why I decided to write this piece for The Telegraph. With that as a starting point, which is when you have a garden like the Bassons, which splits opinion, and you will find an awful lot of, you know, designers and more sort of artistic and creative types really love that garden and thought it was fantastic. And then people who maybe come to Chelsea to see really nice gardens in their minds, you know, that match their idea of what a garden is and that they can take ideas home from. They weren't so impressed and they couldn't understand why it had, you know, won best in show and why it got such a high score, because as far as they were concerned, it just wasn't a garden. So I just found that really interesting, this huge polarization. And it reminded me of, you know, maybe not quite as strong, but this sort of society of Brexit and Trump and everything that's happening now. People are very virulent and loud in their views, and there's a lot of polarization everywhere. And I just thought it was amazing that even in the very tame sort of gardening world, that you had this level of, I wouldn't even say aggression, but definitely a level of high feeling about it, and an awful lot of chatter on Twitter about it.
Okay, we're going to leave this here just for 1 minute, because I had only intended to record one episode with Stephanie. However, it turns out that Irish people tend to talk a lot. So we're going to continue this into a part two. Just bear with me. Come back here next Friday. Pretend you've been watching Back to the Future and time has paused and stopped still and you own a DeLorean, and we'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow and Sideshow.com.